From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made on Wednesday, October 2nd, in a Dallas courtroom. It was sentencing day for a former Dallas police officer named Amber Geiger, a white woman convicted of murdering 26-year-old Botham Jean in his own apartment. Geiger lived in an apartment that was on the third floor of that building, directly below Jean's apartment on the fourth floor. Geiger had gone to the fourth floor and entered Jean's apartment. She told the court she thought it was her own that she was going into, and she saw a figure of a man in the dark. She says she thought she was being burglarized, so she pulled her gun and fired. Jean was killed. Geiger was convicted of murder. Prosecutors had asked for 28 years in prison, honoring the age Botham Jean would have been at Geiger's sentencing. Instead, Geiger received a sentence of 10 years. In court, the judge offered the victim's brother a chance to speak. 20-year-old Brant Jean had some things to say, and here's how it was described by Dallas Morning News reporter Jennifer Emily. Quote, "This was Brant Jean's chance to tell Geiger exactly what he thought of the former Dallas officer after she was sentenced to prison for murdering his brother. Jean took a breath into the microphone and began to speak. He hadn't told his family what he planned to say, he told Geiger. He was speaking for himself. If you truly are sorry, Jean said, I know I can speak for myself. I forgive you. Jean told Geiger that he wanted what Botham would have wanted. I think giving your life to Christ would be the best thing that Botham would want for you, he told her. I love you as a person, and I don't wish anything bad on you. He told Geiger that he didn't even want her to go to prison. Can I give her a hug, please? He asked the court. Please. State District Judge Tammy Kemp gave him the okay. Geiger hesitated for just a moment, and then she rushed toward Jean and wrapped her arms around his neck. Twice, Jean and Geiger started to pull apart, but then hugged again. Both were in tears when they finally broke away. End quote. Now, that act of forgiveness went instantly viral. It earned a salute and admiration from thousands of people. But some commentators had a different view of it. Here's Associated Press writer Aaron Haynes. Quote, many black Americans saw something all too familiar and were offended. Some saw the rush to forgive as a rush to forget racial violence. They argued that the gesture of forgiveness took the focus off the crime and made it all about the white woman. They complained, too, that it served to soothe white people's conscience. And they said that white America has practically come to expect black people to forgive when violence is done to them. Too often, they said, the public acts of black people are not entitled to express anger, even when there is ample reason to be upset, end quote. Well, this hour, we're talking about the concept of forgiveness. Who deserves it and when? The Western New York Restorative Practices Conference is happening this Saturday, and they've been thinking about Botham and Brant Jean. We'll preview their conference this hour and tell you all about it. Our guests this hour include the executive director. You're going to hear it called PIRI this hour. It stands for Partners in Restorative Initiatives. That's Shira May. Welcome back to the program. Nice to have you.
Thank you. Nice to have you here.
Also with us is Danielle Ponder. Danielle, as you know, is a criminal defense attorney. He's going to be a keynote speaker at the conference on Saturday. She teaches at Brockport and RIT. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
And Ronalyn Pollock is here. Ronnie is executive director of the Native American Cultural Center and host of Two Canoes with Ronnie Pollock. She'll be leading a breakout event at the conference on Saturday as well, and teaches at MCC. Nice to have you back here. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
A short hello from our producer, Megan Mack, who's going to tell you that we are in day one of our fall membership campaign. Hi.
Hi, you just stole my line. That's all I needed to say. We're in day one.
Well, goodbye.
we are in day one, but it is a very important day here at WXXI because we need your support to keep Connections and other programs like it on WXXI going. We are here because of you. I just came back from a public radio conference in New Orleans, and there I learned that we are one of the very few talk shows in the country, few local talk shows. There are maybe a handful. So when you think about WXXI, think about how fortunate you are to live in a community that has its own talk show. And, Evan, I should say, all of those other talk shows were just 1 hour. Ours was the only two-hour show. So 454-6300, it's your chance to pledge your support, not only to WXXI, but also to Connections, to keep me and Evan here and our wonderful guests so you can learn about important topics going on in our community. Just think about what you'd be missing if you didn't have Connections in your day. I should also mention that today is New Member Monday. Our goal is to sign up 50 new members. And a generous couple in Irondequoit has agreed to invest $2,000, an extra $2,000 if we can sign up 50 new members by 6 o'clock today. We're about halfway there. So sign up, help us achieve that goal. And when you do it, let them know that you're listening to Connections. 454-6300.
Thank you, Megan Mack. That's producer Megan Mack. And Let's talk a little bit before we dive into the Botham Jean case. I want to make sure you know what PIRI is, because if you hear PIRI, Partners in Restorative Initiatives, Shira May is the executive director. What's the mission of Partners in Restorative Initiatives?
So we are a nonprofit organization that supports restorative practices in communities, in schools, and in the justice system. We've actually been around for 20 years and started out as the Finger Lakes Restorative Justice Coalition, a group of volunteers who wanted to see if restorative justice principles could be helpful in our justice system, especially for first-time offenders and juvenile offenders trying to take those cases into community collaboration solutions. Right now, we serve many school districts in our area, teaching staff how to use community building circles to have strengthen a sense of inclusivity, belonging, giving students a voice in their schools and communities. And we also serve community organizations helping to strengthen workplaces. We can do team building and also conflict resolution.
PIRIRochester.org is P-I-R-I. That's the website, PIRIRochester.org. And you can still register and attend Saturday at St. John Fisher, the conference, yes? What's the goal with the conference?
So this conference is for anyone who has an interest in restorative practices, from people who have just maybe heard that phrase and want to learn a little bit more, all the way to experienced practitioners who can get some advanced topics. We have our keynote speakers, amazing Danielle Ponder, is going to... bless us with a performance and a presentation. And our other keynote speaker is Lauren Abramson, a very experienced practitioner from Baltimore. And then we have breakout sessions in the areas of schools. So we have school leaders from RCSD, from BOCES, from other districts in our area. And then we have community leaders, faith communities. And our friend Ronnie will be talking about her topic of forgiveness, today's topic. And then we have folks from the criminal justice system here in Monroe County, also from our friends in Buffalo talking about their work in the courts.
So that's on Saturday. And again, it's PIRIRochester.org if you want to be there. And I think what I want to start by doing is just asking our guests to kind of weigh in on their general thoughts on the subject of forgiveness as it relates to the Botham Jean case. I'll start with Danielle Ponder. We're kind of laughing because we know it's complex. It's complicated. And when that story 3 weeks ago hit, it instantly goes viral. There's this instant first celebration of the moment of the hug and the act of forgiveness on behalf of Brant Jean. But then a little bit of pushback, or at least a conversation. How did it land with you?
I mean, I had to do a lot of thinking. I'll be honest to say, when I first saw the hug, I was like, really? Are you kidding me? Because it went from this moment of her being sentenced and Black folks feeling like finally there's been an officer who's held accountable. And that's really important for a community who has experienced so much death and so much lack of accountability. And so that was my first instinct. Okay, so now we're all going to focus on the hug. But then I really had to check my own self, because I always talk about being a proponent of restorative justice. I always talk about forgiveness, but this time it was a white officer who killed a Black man. And so that was a little bit more challenging for me. So my first, one thing I will say in regards to the brother, I really didn't have an issue with that, because I think everyone grieves in the way that they, whatever he needs to make him feel better, then that's fine. And if that's how his part of his grieving process, then more power to him. The judge really triggered me, though, only because I've worked in the system for so long and have seen clients who have done things that are just minor.
Can I explain briefly? Because yes. I want to make sure, I didn't mention the judge in the intro. I want to make sure our listeners know exactly what Danielle's talking about. So Brant Jean speaks. They have this moment. They hug. Brant Jean leaves the courtroom. The family is leaving. And the judge in this case is an African-American woman who talked to the Jean family, and then was talking to Amber Geiger, who is crying, and then she goes to hug the judge, and the judge allows her to hug, and they embrace. Mm-hmm. And let me just read what, because apparently they were saying some things to each other, and again, quoting the Dallas Morning News, only the judge's responses to Amber Geiger during their hug were heard. "Ma'am," the judge said, "it's not because I am good. It's because I believe in Christ. None of us are worthy. Forgive yourself." Mm-hmm. That's what the judge said mm-hmm. to Amber Geiger. That bothered you.
So, yes, it bothered me because I've seen how my clients are treated in court. I've probably represented 1,000 or more people. Never have I seen a judge engage in this way with a client. So I think after I had that initial reaction, what I had to sit on is it's not that I don't want Amber Geiger to be hugged as much as I think that room for compassion and for love should exist throughout the court system and shouldn't only exist when there's a white police officer on trial. I mean, that's where I have to fall, because then I can't the next day say, you know, my clients deserve compassion and love if I'm not willing to say Amber Geiger also deserves it. But there are some nuances, and the nuances here is the racial issue. And I completely agree with what you said earlier, black people are expected to forgive. Black people are expected to have the characteristics that this country has never had when it's done wrong. No one's forgiving and forgetting any of the attackers in 9/11, right? But black people, when things are done to them, our nonviolence, kindness, forgiveness is always elevated as the way that we should respond. We should never be angry. We should never riot. We should never, I mean, you look at the Black Lives Matter movement. Any act that was considered angry and or violent, or even just protesting in the street, was, well, you shouldn't do it that way. You should just be peaceful and calm. So we are supposed to have aspire to these attributes that our country itself does not exhibit. And so I think we need to talk about that. But I do believe in restorative justice, and I'm firm on that.
I'll tell you what. You are the most consistent person. We've talked many times mm-hmm. in recent years. I remember a conversation with you. This must be several years back now. I don't know if it was Brock Turner or whatever the case was, in which a white person got a lenient sentence for a violent crime.
Mm-hmm.
And what you told us was, it's not that I don't want that white kid to get a lenient yeah. sentence. It's that I want my African-American clients to get the same consideration.
Mm-hmm.
And you're basically saying that I hear much of the same thing today. You had a complex reaction that kind of moved you in different directions watching what happened in that courtroom. But you're asking yourself, okay, it's not that I don't want this for this white woman, but why is it only seem to be flowing in that direction?
Yes, I've never seen any. And most probably defense attorneys will tell you, they've never seen anything like that.
A judge hugging one of your clients.
Oh, my goodness. What? Just the thought of it is like mind-blowing that a judge would get down from the bench. And maybe people who aren't in court don't realize how shocking that is. But for a judge to get down from the bench and hug a client, maybe in mental health court or drug court, but I haven't even seen it there. But it's really, judges really try to be impartial. Typically, they lean towards chastising clients more, especially a murder defendant. Are you kidding me? That would never happen. But I do think there's something powerful in that moment. And so when I look at just the human beings in the courtroom, I can't take away from how beautiful it is to be able to show compassion in that way. But we have to talk about the nuances in the case.
So before I turn to the other guests, one more question for you on that subject. Here's what Jamel Hill wrote. She's a staff writer for the Atlantic Monthly after Judge Tammy Kemp also hugged Amber Geiger. Hill wrote the following, quote, "How Botham Jean's brother chooses to grieve is his business. He's entitled to that. But this judge choosing to hug this woman is unacceptable to me. Keep in mind, this is a convicted murderer, the same one who laughed about Martin Luther King Jr.'s assassination and killing people on sight." End mm-hmm, quote. Mm-hmm. That's Jamel Hill. What she seems to be saying there is, similar to what you said, okay, the brother is going to grieve in his way. And there may be something beautiful in that act of forgiveness. But this is a judge, and there's a different standard, and there's a different idea here. And what Jamel Hill is saying is, I don't see the kind of contrition that I wanted to see in Amber Geiger. The laughing about MLK, laughing about killing people on site. You know. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely. I mean, I think if we had a different system, if we had a community-oriented system that was based in restorative justice, we could receive this. But Jemele Hill also knows what happens to Black defendants, what happens to Latino defendants. So I think it's striking for many people because we've seen our brothers and our sisters and our cousins go through the court process. We've seen them yelled at by judges. We've seen judges be cold and not listen to mitigating consequences or mitigating circumstances. That happens all the time. So for us to see a white woman kind of lifted up in this way by the court is really hard to process. I definitely think the judge goes a step too far, but I would love to see a system where love is the guiding principle. And so if I believe that, then it has to be for everyone. And, you know, it kind of feels icky to even say it, but it's just the truth. I want that thing, then anyone who walks in that court has to receive it.
I respect that struggle that you have with it. I respect that you opening up about sort of the ambivalence you may feel. Ronnie Pollack, let me just start with the Botham Jean case, and then I want to kind of broaden it out to questions on some of the similar themes that Danielle just discussed. But what did you make of that particular case and that act of forgiveness?
Yeah, I think when I saw that act of forgiveness, it just resonated with me just based on my experience with forgiveness and how I've worked with clients in the past before on the topic of forgiveness, my own experiences that I've had in the area of forgiveness. So to me, it wasn't as big of a shock as it is, I think, for many other people in our society, because that's just not our knack, you know. It's just not a part of our human nature to look at a situation like that and be like, oh yeah, well, forgiveness makes sense. You know, I mean, it seems as though what comes to mind right away is no, there needs to be accountability and, you know, they need to serve whatever is due to them, you know, that had the judgment that has been brought upon them. And sometimes almost holding this thought of like, well, they have to earn, you know, forgiveness. They have to do something to earn that forgiveness. But when you really experience forgiveness, you recognize that it's nothing that can be earned. You know, it's a gift that the person doing the act of forgiveness gives to the person that maybe collectively all the other people see as, well, that's undeserved. But that's not, you know, the common aspect of focus.
No, it's interesting. When you say, in your view, in some cases, it's not something that could even be earned. That might take people aback. But when you think about it, you know, if Brant Jean wants to say to Amber Geiger, I forgive you, that is his to give, because nothing is going to bring back Botham Jean. Mm-hmm. There's no act of behavior on behalf of Amber Geiger that's going to bring back Botham Jean and the judgment and the mistake and the murder that she committed. So that's why you think in many ways that's just a gift for his to give or not give, not for hers to earn?
Yeah, definitely. It's a gift for him to make the decision on giving. Because a lot of times, yeah, the knack is that, you know, we also think, well, they not only do they not deserve it and they need to earn it, but sometimes we look at it as, well, why are you letting that person off the hook? You know, in your act of forgiveness, you're letting them get off too easy. No way. You know, you should be angry towards them. You should hold and harbor that unforgiveness. But then there's, you know, all kinds of byproducts that come as a result when we do harbor that unforgiveness. I mean, things like, you know, bitterness and hatred, resentment, all those kinds of things, you know, that then produce toxic emotions and, you know, can create the body to be at a place of illness. But the other thing, too, is in the act of forgiveness, especially in a situation like this, you know, I think what is hard sometimes for people to understand, you know, especially those that maybe haven't gone through a significant experience of forgiveness, is that an act of forgiveness, too, it also requires you to be willing to forgive someone's character. And sometimes that can be a struggle. That can be the most difficult part of forgiveness.
Well, when I read what the Associated Press writer Aaron Haynes was saying about some of the reaction from African Americans to what they saw in that Dallas courtroom, I also think about what Native peoples might think about the notion of forgiveness, this idea that you know, Ronnie is a member of the Mississaugas and the New Credit First Nation, and to state the obvious, ours is a country that is premised on the dispossession of Native peoples. And now there are treaties that are respected or not respected, often sort of ignored when it's inconvenient. And the idea that, well, you know, let's forgive, you know, and so do you see echoes of that in what Aaron Haynes was writing? Do you feel that as well?
Yeah, I do. You know, and I think it's also in my adult life as I've come to learn my culture more because I wasn't necessarily really raised with it. And I've learned the aspects of who we genuinely are as people. That would just be something that would be a part of our core. Especially as a Haudenosaunee, there's an aspect of saying something, for instance, as the Thanksgiving address, you know, as a Haudenosaunee person, that's something that you would say every day. And it puts you into that mind frame and that mindset of allowing, you know, your heart, your spirit, your mind to be in that place of being willing to forgive. Because we understand and we're thankful for everything that has been given to us on a day-to-day basis. And also, too, with the Thanksgiving address, it also invites us to be in a space of what we call a good mind. And there's nothing that, as a Haudenosaunee person, we would want to do to intercept or cloud, you know, being in a good mind.
That's a lot of burden on people who have either been oppressed, dispossessed, and worse, mm-hmm. to do the forgiving. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of burden, isn't it?
It is. It is. Yeah. 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 And that, right, there's so much complexity to the aspect of forgiveness because it is. That burden is big. But when you extend, you know, that forgiveness, and again, it's a gift that you give to someone, it releases you. It invites your healing to take place. And I think that is more important than still, you know, wanting to hang on to it because you're trying to hold the person or the entity in trying to hold them accountable.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Shira, how did you react to the Balthazar, the Brant Jean's forgiveness of Amber Geiger in that courtroom?
I honestly felt very uncomfortable watching it, and I think because I'm thinking about the racial dynamic of people who will take that video clip and use it to say, oh, this is how Black people should respond to racism. That was the most troubling thing that came to my mind. And as I was reading the comments on Facebook, that's what I would see is African-Americans saying, please don't take that video and tell me how to feel about the oppression that I've experienced. And I think that it's also a misconception about restorative justice that people think forgiveness is part of restorative justice. And it's absolutely not part of the process. It's not a requirement. It's not, in fact, an outcome that's found empirically to be one of the major outcomes. Victims do not have to forgive offenders in order for there to be benefits of restorative justice. The purpose of restorative justice is for the person harmed to speak about what happened and how it's affected them and to have some say in how the person can make repairs and they can feel empowered. And in fact, there was a case of a murder where the years and years later, which is often what happens in restorative justice, is the victims are not ready to be face to face with the offenders until they have done their healing and processing. But years and years later, this family of a murder victim came face to face with the offender and they got to tell what had happened to their family, how it affected them. And when asked, do you forgive them? They said, if you could bring my child back, I would forgive you. And that was a very honest reaction from how they were experiencing their trauma at the moment. And that was the end of the restorative process. Nonetheless, everybody involved felt some satisfaction in being able to speak their truth. So that's something that I think is important for people to realize. Forgiveness is an individual process. I think it's a beautiful process when it happens. But I think of it as, and from personal experience and also from reading this literature, it happens not necessarily as an intention at the outset, but as an outcome of healing. I feel that when people can truthfully acknowledge the harm and their feelings and anger and rage, all of the trauma that comes from being being victimized, forgiveness can happen. And being in a room with someone where you can hear the other person's story can lead to forgiveness, but doesn't always.
Did you find yourself thinking, Shira, when you saw that video of Brant Jean, maybe something along the lines of, you know, this for him is a very important act to engage in, that he needs to be able to forgive, that it is in its own way, it's a beautiful moment. And did you almost wish it had happened in a private room, not with cameras there, so he could have it, but it didn't send some sort of a message that, because to your point, here's what I saw a lot of. I saw a lot of people sort of posting on the story and saying, more of this, please, more of this, more of this, more of this, mm-hmm. which I get that sentiment. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, I hear Danielle and I hear Ronnie, like, we all want this world of forgiveness and love and an expectation that love comes first here. But we have our history that is real.
I did think of that. I did think it might have been less harmful to people of color for him to do that privately. But I absolutely valued his process, just like what Danielle said. That was his own choice. And then the mother and the rest of the family members spoke very differently about how they were feeling. I think hearing stories of people who have been victims of crime, especially racism, I think we need to hear those stories. What I really fear from this conversation was that it denies people the stories of how they've been harmed. It leads white people, because like you mentioned earlier, we are very good at denying and minimizing the effects of racism and saying, I have nothing to do with that. We are complicit in this society where people of color are targeted and victimized and murdered in their homes by police officers, and I believe that we need to be anti-racist and speak up against that. And I want to give you a little analogy about the healing process and where forgiveness comes into play. I forget who gave me this analogy first, but imagine that someone has stabbed you in the back with a knife, and the knife is still there, and you can't get it out. It's behind you. That's what racism is like. It's still happening. It's not that it happened in the past and you're now trying to heal from it. People are being murdered and people are being victimized and discriminated against now. So for someone to say to you, well, it would be really healing for you to forgive, it does not make sense in the stage where we're at. What we need to say is, let's end this harm so that healing can happen.
Yeah, and one more kind of question on the process, because again, I think there may be some surprise for listeners to hear that forgiveness is not necessarily it is not a necessary component of restorative practices.
Right.
So does this story, which again, I want to sort of uphold, especially for Brant Jean, not only his right, obviously his right, But the inherent beauty in that moment, I mean, there was a lot of pain on display, and that was, I'm sure, not easy for anybody involved. But does it sort of create this standard where, well, what he did is what you should aspire to, as opposed to this idea that if we cannot forgive, that is not required for restorative practice? In other words, like creating the standard that, well, what if you really work at it, that's where you'll get to, mm-hmm. is the Brant Jean standard.
Right. There is no requirement to forgive in restorative justice. And in fact, I in my own reading about healing of trauma, it is not required to forgive in order to heal trauma. Forgiveness does come to many people when they engage in healing. But for example, someone who has recently been a victim or survivor of crime, it would be detrimental to their mental health to encourage them to forgive too early in the process. That actually shames people, creates an unrealistic standard to say you shouldn't feel the anger and rage and betrayal and bitterness that you feel. And I think especially in complex traumas, childhood traumas, intergenerational traumas, patterns where families are continuing to replay those traumas, what first needs to happen is taking care of ourselves and healing ourselves. And I wanted to share a little of a personal story as well. I'm a survivor and thriver of childhood sexual abuse. I experienced quite severe sexual abuse from multiple people in my childhood. And there are moments when I, along my healing journey, experience forgiveness. It sometimes will come while I'll say to myself, you know what, I don't harbor resentment towards that person in this moment. But for the most part, I don't feel like I'm forgiving of the folks who betrayed me as a child. And I think that that's It's all a personal journey, and it's especially would be unfair for anyone to tell somebody you should really be working on forgiveness right now.
So do you find yourself not even thinking much about forgiveness, that it's more incidental, but your process involves other things? Or are there times where you think someday I might be able to forgive this person?
You know, because I am a peacemaker, I work in this field of peace and healing, I do ask myself, you know, am I forgiving today? How am I feeling today? It is a daily process and check-in. And it is a belief, there's a spiritual belief in my system that people are inherently good, that I ultimately believe people have good in them. And I think, too, once I can hear another person's perspective, then my perspective changes. I think forgiveness is often a result of understanding another person's story. But I think it's absolutely been important to my journey to allow myself, today I don't forgive. No, I'm not feeling forgiving today. And another thing for me is my Jewish upbringing, the concept of forgiveness is approached really differently than I think in Christian traditions, as far as I know. In the Jewish tradition, forgiveness is about I need to be forgiven for the harm I have caused. And we use the term teshuva, which means to make things right. It's not about forgiving other people. It's about I need to do the work to make things right for those I have harmed.
We're talking about forgiveness in the context of the story of the murder of Botham Jean, who was 26 years old and in Dallas in 2018 lived in an apartment building, lived directly on a floor. He lived on the floor above or below, a Dallas police officer, and she mistook his apartment for her own. That's what she told the court. She came into that apartment. She saw him in the darkness, said that she thought she was being burglarized, and she shot him. And he died. And she was convicted of murder. And at the sentencing, Botham Jean's brother, a 20-year-old, Brant Jean, forgave her and hugged her. And the judge, an African-American woman, also hugged her and told her, forgive yourself. So it's a question of the process of forgiveness, how it fits into restorative practice or not, and how we all undertake that. And we're also talking about what PIRI Rochester has coming up on Saturday. PIRI is Partners in Restorative Initiatives. So you're hearing Shira May, who is the executive director. They have a conference on restorative practices on Saturday. It's at St. John Fisher College. And if you hear us talking about that, as you heard over the years, or maybe it comes up in your kid's school, or you hear about that in the news somewhere, this is a chance to learn all about restorative practices, to hear from Danielle Ponder, to hear from Ronnie Pollack, to hear from so many others, and to really dig in and learn. And if you want to register, you can still do that. It's PIRIRochester.org, P-I-R-I, Rochester.org. Danielle Ponder is here with us, a criminal defense attorney, keynote speaking at Saturday's conference. She teaches at Brockport and RIT. And Ronnie Pollack is here, who is the executive director of the Native American Cultural Center, host of Two Canoes with Ronnie Pollack on WYSL. And she teaches at MCC. She'll also be there presenting, leading a breakout session. As we're going to talk more about what they're going to do, we'll get your feedback as well if you want to join the conversation on forgiveness. 844-295-TALK. It's toll free. 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester. 263-9994. Coming up in our second hour, a conversation with the founders of the Muse School. That's in Calabasas, California. The founders are in Rochester, spreading the message of what they call passion-based learning. They let kids get involved in setting some of the learning agenda, what they want to learn about, what they're passionate about, how to build that into other parts of the program. We'll talk about it, and we'll talk about the future of education next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Joyce in Penfield, first on the phone. Go ahead, Joyce.
Thanks. This is a wonderful and important program, Evan. I'm questioning, did I hear correctly that the judge, when she stepped down, also indicated that there was in a religious way.
Yes.
That she when we're talking about nuance, in a sense, you know, the brother certainly had a perfect right to express his forgiveness and to cast it in his personal religious perspective, whatever that would be. But for the judge to speak of forgiveness in a religious perspective is a pretty dramatic violation of the key democratic tenet, you know, enshrined in the Constitution of the separation of church and state. And in the context of Attorney General Barr, who last week at a speech at Notre Dame portrayed Christianity as under attack and said that the founders, the framers of our Constitution, believed that free government was only for believers, and it's totally incorrect. It was for believers and non-believers alike, and he wants religious people to be able to discriminate on any basis they claim is a violation of their religion. So we're, I think, at a dramatic point in our country where the whole concept of church and state is not only being eroded in many ways, but to have a person who's the Attorney General speak in such a way to encourage these infractions. And so here we see it happening at a lower level.
Joyce, thank you for the phone call. So let me work backwards on that point. And I'll just say that Attorney General Barr has, to use a euphemism, some interesting religious views. And during his own confirmation hearings, when these kind of things come up, there's often this deflection that, well, you know, you can't probe too much on religion. Well, for people in power, I think those questions are probably fine. And some of what Joyce is talking about is why it might be relevant to at least probe that a little bit more. But what she's also talking about is the judge. And I'm going to sum up as best I can from the news reports I saw. The judge, in the case of Amber Guyger sentencing, talking to Amber Guyger, the Dallas police officer who murdered Botham Jean, the judge did hug her. She referred to the Bible. And clearly Guyger was saying something to her, you know, thank you for forgiving me or something along those lines. And the judge was saying, you know, she was pointing to the Bible, basically saying, this is what you need to be reading, and I can't forgive you. You got to forgive yourself, and kind of admonishing her to keep reading the Bible. Joyce has a problem with that. You were talking about judge's conduct. Would you have a problem with that if that were your client?
I mean, I think that's inappropriate. I don't think it rises to the level of a constitutional violation, but I think telling her to read the Bible is very problematic. So judges are really supposed to be impartial, but also, you know, it's really invoking religion, you know, like this is the thing that will help you. My specific text for my specific religion. So I think most judges, most attorneys would probably agree that went a little too far.
When you say typically what you hear judges do is sort of admonish or they're offer more harsh words for defendants.
For someone convicted of murder?
For someone convicted
absolutely.
Of murder.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that, okay. Is it appropriate for the judge to sort of freelance a little and offer maybe some personal advice, which is what the judge seemed to be doing here?
You know, in the system that we currently have, absolutely not, right? In the system that we currently have, if a person is convicted of murder, most of the energy is going to the victim's family. Any words of compassion and love that a judge expressed typically is towards the family. I've never heard, not that I've sat in tons of murder trials, but it's rare to see anything other than a judge telling the defendant what you did, how you've caused harm, how you've impacted the community. So this is a remarkable case, I think, by all means. But the other thing I wonder, you know, this was filmed. There were reporters. So, you know, this could have probably happened without the media and it wouldn't have been a big deal at all. But it just happened to be a big case, you know.
Mm-hmm. Let me get back to your phone call. Stephanie and Victor next. Go ahead, Stephanie.
Boy, it's really tough. If a person chooses to be a Christian, I believe that there's a prayer that was given called the Our Father. We have what's called the crucifixion, where Jesus begged for forgiveness. But we also have the other side of the coin, where we just can't forget about justice and trying to get into this world what appears to be justice and compassion for those who need it. It's a really tough road to hoe. And I can appreciate where people from lots of sides are coming from. But if a person does choose to be a Christian, forgiveness has to be at least a big component of that life. So that's all I've got to say. Take it or leave it.
Well, no, Stephanie, I appreciate the phone call. And I'll just point out the irony that evangelical Christians are still largely supporting this president. And this president, mm-hmm. when he was speaking to Bob Lonsberry, when he was running for president, said that his favorite book was the Bible and his favorite verse was Eye for an Eye. That's the, I mean, that's not necessarily the Christian ethic that Stephanie is talking about from the perspective of forgiveness. Mm. Now, Donald Trump is, he doesn't really read books. He tells you that. So I'm sure he has not read the Bible. I'm sure he's familiar with Eye for an Eye. And I'm sure he's not a biblical scholar. But Stephanie's idea is that there is something Christian in that ethic. Shira, is there something to that too?
Well, a lot of religions have this common theme of forgetting the eye for an eye for a minute, the theme of treating everyone as in the image of God, that everyone has a core self that is good and redeemable. And I think love is a universal language. So I think people from different faiths can relate to the concept of forgiveness as a principle and the principle of loving oneself and loving others. And I think that people are on their own individual path. What I think happens, and I have heard this called spiritual bypassing, mm-hmm. is when people claim that you must forgive and love everyone else without doing the really hard work of acknowledging your emotions, acknowledging harm that was done to you and harm that you've done to others.
Well, I would think there may be a risk, and I'm thinking on the fly here, so this may be clumsy or just wrong, but there may be a risk to being so desiring to forgive that you allow yourself to be set up to be harmed again. That if you are constantly just sort of being a proverbial doormat, then you're going to get trampled. And I am not saying that in a way that says never forgive. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense, Shira?
Absolutely. I think that for folks who have experienced victimization, it's very common to then internalize that belief system of having low self-esteem and low efficacy and not standing up for yourself and having strong boundaries. So there's a few different issues going on. I also feel clumsy talking about it because the word forgiveness has a lot of different meanings and mm-hmm. connotations. And often people will think forgiveness means letting people off the hook or it wasn't important what you did or that, you shouldn't have any consequences. And I really think forgiveness is just in the mental health literature is something you do for yourself. It's to release the resentment that you carry. It's to free yourself.
Let me go ahead and read an email from Michael because it has me thinking about what Ronnie said earlier. Michael says, it took me a long time to understand this, but the person who benefits the most from forgiving is the forgiving person because it's so much better than caring about anger, hatred, resentment. How do you square that with the desire to make sure that your forgiveness is not used as some sort of a green light to further harm you? Does that make sense, Ronnie?
It does. And I'm a true believer, too, in the fact that when we do forgive, we don't forgive and forget. I feel like we forgive, we learn from the experience, and we move on. Because otherwise, to forgive and forget, I mean, it would essentially be equatable to allowing yourself to be a doormat. And I'm certainly not a proponent of that. And I really feel like, too, the act of forgiveness is something that is so personal and so individual. So even in this case here that we've been talking about today, while that's what was collectively represented there and, you know, went viral for all of us to see, it is such a personal journey. You know, I feel like it's really unfair for us to say, okay, we all need to look at that and everybody needs to try and aspire to that because that's just, unrealistic because again, it's such a personal journey and a personal process. That's the other thing too, with forgiveness, you know, much like it's been talked about here already today, like you can't, you know, ask a victim who is in the process of healing and, you know, is maybe still experiencing some of the trauma mm-hmm. to, okay, forgive. No, that it has to come through a process. Yeah.
All right. So briefly, I want each of our guests to tell you what they're going to be focusing on in Saturday's conference. And I'm pulling up my, oh, Ronnie, so you're leading a breakout session at the conference on Saturday. It's entitled The Healing Power of Forgiveness. So just building on some of the themes we've been talking about this hour?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So I share some of my own personal experiences, too, in the healing power of forgiveness and how it was utilized first in a family business deal gone horribly awry and how we suffered trauma from that mm-hmm. for many, many years, but how ultimately it ended in forgiveness. And going through that experience allowed me to then, it was like this awakening. You know, I could see other areas and opportunities in my life to experience forgiveness with other people, other okay. intimate people in my life.
And Daniel Ponder is going to be giving the keynote address entitled For the Love of Justice, Building a Justice System with Transformative and Redemptive Power. That's a big ask.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So I'm going to talk about what I've been talking about and screaming about forever. One, I like to localize the issue of mass incarceration and talk about what's happening in Monroe County, what's happening in our criminal justice system. And then I like to give people a vision of how we can create a better system. And I think that's really through creating connections, building community. And I really do believe that love can be a guiding principle in justice. So I just share some of my experiences in court, some of my experiences with family members who've been incarcerated, and just the space I know that we can enter if we're dedicated to really rebuilding and rehabilitating as opposed to punishment.
Are you confident that our country can move in that direction?
No. That's the truth. I'm not. But what else am I going to do? Just say nothing? So every day I feel like nothing's going to change. But what is my other option? To just sit there and be quiet? So I'm just going to keep saying it and saying it, and maybe, you know, something will happen.
Well, then let me ask that sort of a different way, because, I mean, I certainly understand and I don't begrudge you with the pessimism. But over the course of your career, have you had people share with you that something in them has moved, has changed? Have you seen that, either in conversation, action, et cetera?
Yes. So I guess your question, do I feel hopeful that the country will change and that's a big thing that
absolutely.
I just can't get there yet?
Yeah, absolutely.
But do I think we're having the conversation about criminal justice? We're talking about it in a different way? We absolutely are. But I do, you know, one of my students said something that I just was blown away by. She said it's very dangerous to chase the feeling of justice. And until we can redefine what it means for something to feel like justice, we're going to always be in this place, because I think people say, throw them under the rug or throw them under the building, under the jail. You know, when things happen, whether it's from when things happen, we tend to go to punishment, and it seems to be so ingrained in our psyche. So I think it's going to take a lot of time to reverse that feeling of punishment, and not healing. So I shouldn't say I'm not hopeful, but I guess you're supposed to say you're hopeful. But that was just the truth.
I don't want to have like a... You know, Stephen Colbert had this moment talking to Ta-Nehisi Coates, and Ta-Nehisi Coates said, like, it's not my job to make you hopeful. I'm not hopeful. You know, people were kind of taken aback by it. I don't think it's anybody's job to express hope if they don't feel it, or optimism.
I think if they don't to say this. I've been black for 37 years. So I often meet white people who have just learned about racism in the past 10 years. Tell me you should be more hopeful. And I'm like, you haven't been in this game for a long time. You spent your first 20 years not even thinking about it. I'm at 37 right now. So for me, the little change I'm seeing is great, but it can be very hard to feel like the big change, the paradigm shift is going to occur. But I guess there's a part of me that is believing it, because I keep saying this message over and over.
Well, it's like you said, what else are you going to do, right?
Right.
But I'm more appreciative of your honesty than any sort of false presentation of optimism. Yeah. I think it's instructive for us, and I'm grateful that you were here this hour. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
30 seconds, Ronnie. How's your optimism these days on where this country's going?
I'm hopeful. I mean, I really hope I'm not collectively one of those people that, you know, sees the world through rose-colored glasses. But I feel like, you know, the fact that there are more conversations happening and there are more explorations happening into the area of forgiveness, I feel like for me, that's just what's always at my core and what's always the most important thing. Regardless of what the issue is, it's a matter of that person being able to achieve inner forgiveness and healing.
Thank you for being here this hour.
Thank you.
It's always nice to have you. And Shira May, the Executive Director of Partners in Restorative Initiatives. I always appreciate the conversation with Shira. We go back a little while now.
I know. It's met nice. At the Pittsburgh Food Market.
Oh, my gosh. It's nice. PiriRochester.org, P-I-R-I. That's the organization. It's Partners in Restorative Initiatives. And if you go to the website, PiriRochester.org, you can learn about the conference on Saturday. You can register and take part. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much. And to our wonderful panelists and guests today. It's going to be an exciting event on Saturday.
Good luck with that. Thank you. And more connections coming up.